It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Prisoners who spend prolonged periods in solitary confinement are susceptible to a number of mental health disorders. They can include anxiety, depression, and paranoia. Much like post-traumatic stress disorder, the effects of these health concerns can continue for a long time. Tomorrow marks the beginning of a two-day conference at the University of Pittsburgh that explores the health ramifications of and alternatives to prolonged isolation during incarceration. I'm joined now in studio by the conference organizer, Jules Lobel, who is the Bessie McKee Walthour Endowed Chair in Pitt School of Law. Professor Lobel, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us in studio is Professor Michael Zygmunt of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. Professor Zygmunt, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much.
And with us by phone is Chandra Delaney, mother of one of the Dallas Six and coordinator of the Justice for the Dallas Six organization. Chandra Delaney, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can join the conversation with a comment or question at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Professor Lobel, you are leading this conference. Explain what's on the agenda and how you plan to specifically address the health and legal issues surrounding prolonged solitary confinement.
Well, the health, we're bringing a wide array of diverse academics, neuroscientists, neurobiologists, psychologists, medical professors, social scientists, all of whom are going to look at the health consequences of solitary confinement, of putting somebody in a very small cell, not letting them out for years, the psychological consequences, the physical consequences, the rise in hypertension, the rise in heart disease, and the consequences for the brain and the structure and anatomy of the brain, which Michael Zygmunt and a very prominent neuroscientist will be able to talk about. So that'll be the first day. And the second day will be prominent prison officials from both Europe and the United States, as well as lawyers, talking about the alternatives to solitary. This is an unnecessary practice. We don't have to do this.
Well, from a legal standpoint, and I was thinking about this as I was preparing for our conversation, how is it that solitary confinement is not considered cruel and unusual punishment?
That's a question that I've always asked myself. It beats me how it is, because it's that the courts have deferred to prison officials thus far who have said, we need to do this because it's the only way to control the prison population. And I don't think it's necessary, but I think on its face, to lock somebody up in a small cell for 10 years, 15 years, 2 years, 3 years, without giving them any social contact, takes away a basic essence of what makes us humans.
Professor Michael Zygmunt, does solitary confinement have an adverse effect on mentally ill people, and does it make their illness worse?
Well, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a neuroscientist, and I study the biological changes in the brain. But I think the literature's pretty clear that it makes people with mental illness, which is a large percentage of the people in prisons, worse. And it also takes people that don't show mental illness and creates mental illness. So as you yourself suggested, it is cruel and unusual punishment along many dimensions.
Chandra Delaney, mother of one of the Dallas Six, coordinator of the Justice for the Dallas Six organization, your son has been in solitary confinement. Talk about how this has impacted your son and ultimately yourself.
The way it's impacted my son is I think a part of the torture is from a lot of the people are in solitary confinement, not because they've done something wrong, but because they're trying to do something right. My son's a whistleblower and a jailhouse lawyer, so that's part of the reason why he was thrown in there. So he's suffering torture at the hands of the guards, starvation. They are denied the yard, the ability to have a shower, just basic needs. Some of the things that have happened to my son from being in there is he can't, his vision is messed up because the lights are on 24 hours a day. And he said from the people's, you know, sometimes the mentally ill and the people who are not mentally ill are in the same unit. So you're hearing people scream and you're hearing all kind of things, and it affects you mentally and physically.
What is the European form of solitary confinement? It's done differently than it is in the United States. What can you tell us about that, Mr. Lobel?
Well, Europe, and in some places in Europe, they don't have solitary confinement in the way that we know of it. For example, in England, even though there's some solitary confinement, what they try to do is, instead of put people in big yards, 200 people, like the Shawshank Redemption movie it would illustrate, they take people in small groups. So you take somebody who has trouble being in the general population, and you keep them in a small group as opposed to putting them in a big group. You give them some out-of-cell time, but maybe not as much as the general population, but it's not 1 hour a day. You give them better conditions. You give them contact visits, phone calls, all of the things that are often denied in American prisons. So you take measures to separate people, but to give them some social contact and not deny them all social contact and all physical exercise.
Professor Zygmunt, how might that type of approach mitigate the effects of that we're seeing on people who are being sentenced to or given long stretches of solitary confinement?
So let me preface my answer, because that's a very important question, by noting that we are essentially social animals. We evolved as social animals. Our bodies, and especially our brains, only work when we have social contact. We know this even before applying it to solitary confinement by just looking at people who live alone and have few, if any, friends. And that's a significant part of the population out of prison as well as in prison. So they have a variety of physiological problems and a variety of brain problems. And one of the things that people like myself do is we study isolation in laboratory animals. And in that case, we can actually take a look at the brain. And we know that the brain becomes simpler. There are fewer neurons. There are fewer connections between neurons. Basically, the brain begins to fall apart. And solitary confinement combines physical isolation with a kind of impoverished environment. There are no stimuli, or the stimulus that exists, lights on all the time, and noise is very destructive. So I think anything that you can do to reduce that is going to keep the brain from being as dramatically impaired as possible. But at the end of the day, you really want to maximize social contact and physical exercise, or the prisoners will be impaired physically and mentally.
Chandra Delaney, are you able to approach prison officials on behalf of your son? Does a lawyer have to do that in order to prove conditions or to decrease the amount of solitary confinement that your son is placed in? What recourse do you have?
What I've done is keep in constant contact with prison officials, but also from the outside, I have created a network of people who kind of call in. We do call alerts whenever there's situations with prisoners. We do that, and then we also try to reach out to our people in the government, our local government and our state government and our the United States government, to try to keep them aware of what's going on. It's not very easy all the time, but that's what we do most of the time.
412-246-2002 is the number to call to join our conversation about the University of Pittsburgh conference that is looking at the health ramifications of and alternatives to prolonged isolation during incarceration, solitary confinement, etc. Again, our number 412-246-2002, and let's go to David in Braddock Hills. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. See, I see it in a different way. I mean, they're not terrorists. And, you know, we don't have to put them in Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, I mean, to use that as an extreme, you know, they didn't blow up any Twin Towers. They're not here to we're not here to take extract information from them. There's no need to go after them like they bombed a building or anything. So we're treating them more like terrorists, not I know they committed a crime, a murder, but we're out. We don't have to go to that extreme. So
well, David,
there's no need to treat them like that.
David, that's a great point. What is the rationale, Jules Lobel? We heard a little bit from Chandra about how they view her son, as the jailhouse lawyer, and that perhaps for whatever reason has gotten him into trouble with the people running the prison. But what are the rationales that are used for putting a prisoner in solitary confinement?
Yeah, in terms of the rationales, that points out the two major problems. The first is they often use solitary confinement for prisoners who cause problems in one way or the other. They may speak out too much. They may be gang members. They may be get into minor offenses. And there is a general growing consensus that solitary is way overused here, and that the rationale for it's the easiest thing to do. It's the most routine thing to do. You just lock somebody away, don't let them out, and they won't bother you. And it's a bad way of running a prison. The second rationale and the second problem is that there are some people who are very dangerous, who do kill people in prison. And for those people, I think what the solution is to separate them from the general population, but not totally isolate them.
Are there times when solitary confinement is necessary, or is it a bad way to go all the time?
I think it's never necessary, and it's always an inhumane practice. What is necessary sometimes is to separate somebody from the general population, but you don't have to totally isolate them. You don't have to deny them phone calls or contact visits or any group activity.
So you isolate them, which means you put them in a separate cell.
You put them in
They're
a separate
alone,
wing.
But they still have access to things that under the circumstances of the way that solitary confinement is applied now, you wouldn't exclude phone calls. You wouldn't exclude contact with the outside world. Professor Zygmunt, you're nodding your head.
Right. I think we have to be honest here. I think that there are a number of justifications for prison in general and solitary confinement in particular. One is to protect society and other prisoners from violent people. Sometimes people say it's to protect the person in solitary confinement for being be attacked. But at the end of the day, I think most prison and most solitary confinement is society's way of punishing people whose behavior they don't appreciate. And punishment is not a good way to change behavior. And I think there's lots and lots of research that says that punishment doesn't work. And we know that there's a kind of revolving door. People that are in prison, and especially people that are in solitary confinement, when they're released, they often come right back. So we're not doing any kind of rehabilitation. If anything, we are making things worse, not only for society, but for the individual.
Can I just have one comment on what
Sure.
Michael just said? One of the key things that I learned when I visited Norwegian prisons is that in Norway, they view that the prisoner has done a bad act, but is not a bad person and can be rehabilitated, whereas we here tend to view the person who's been convicted of a crime as a bad person and therefore just has to be locked away and there's nothing you can do about them. So I think there has to be a cultural change on how we view prisoners and our whole view of prisoners. In Ohio, there's going to be one high prison official from Ohio is going to talk about an experiment they've done with the four people they consider the most dangerous prisoners who they have in a separate unit. But they recreate with each other. They get phone calls daily to their family and friends, and they have contact visits about every other day with their family or friends, and they get various environmental stimulation. So even though they're not placed with the general population, they're not isolated in the sense that they don't have any human contact or very little social contact.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we are talking about a two-day conference starting tomorrow at the University of Pittsburgh, exploring the health ramifications of isolation during incarceration. With me in studio is the conference organizer, Jules Lobel, the Bessie McKee Waldhauer Endowed Chair in Pitt's School of Law, Also with us is Professor Michael Zygmunt of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School and Chandra Delaney, mother of one of the Dallas Six, coordinator of the Justice for the Dallas Six organization. You can join the conversation. Still have time to take some calls at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. One question that's come up is, as you were discussing what's going on in Norway, Jules Lobel, is it easier for countries like Norway to take a gentler stance because their populations are more homogenous and there's probably less crime in those countries?
It is probably easier, but there are still lessons we could learn from Norway or from England or from Germany. 60 Minutes did a show a couple of weeks ago on Germany where there's a whole different attitude about prisoners and the way you should incarcerate prisoners. So I think we have something to learn from this, even though they're different.
Professor Zygmunt, what is the history of solitary confinement? At what point in our history did someone decide that if you really want to punish somebody, you isolate them and that's all you need to do?
Well, that's a very interesting question for Pittsburghers, because I'm not a historian of solitary confinement, but my understanding is that solitary confinement began in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, in the home of Benjamin Franklin, largely because of a group of Quakers who felt that solitary confinement would be a way to rehabilitate prisoners. It would be a way for them to be isolated so that they could reflect on their bad behavior and change. And that prison that they started in the 1700s still stands. It's called Eastern State Penitentiary. Luckily, it's not used anymore. It's a museum. But I think that although they might have had very good intentions, what they did is create a monster which I would argue, without being too extreme, literally destroys the person. Right from the beginning, the brain begins to literally fall apart.
The prison still stands, and the idea is still being applied, or the method is still being applied. So Chandra Delaney, mother of someone who is in solitary confinement, when you hear the rationale that was being used years ago and is really still being clung to today, what is your reaction? I mean, is there anything good that you see coming out of your son's confinement?
There is nothing good that comes out of solitary confinement, and I just find it to be a draconian use of the system, and it's horrible. I mean, when I think of solitary confinement, what comes to mind is the torture chambers and the dungeons from back in the 1700s, and I mean, it's exactly what it was then, and it does nothing good whatsoever.
Let's take a call from Peggy in Pittsburgh at 412-246-2002. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air.
Hello. I just wanted to call and let people know that Cedric Richmond was a representative from Louisiana, presented a bill in Congress two springs ago to reform solitary confinement in this country. And I just really want to encourage everyone to talk to their representatives about moving that bill ahead. It's been sitting there for 2 years completely nothing happening.
Well, Peggy, I appreciate that phone call, and I'm sure that there may be some people listening who might take you up on that. The United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world. We know that. Has this led to more people being placed in solitary?
Let me say that it isn't one of the highest. It is the highest. The United States has about 5% of the world's population, and it has 25% of the world's prisoners. And of those prisoners, it's hard to know for sure, but something like 80,000 people are in solitary confinement. So we are way off the charts in terms of imprisonment and solitary confinement. And as a country that prides itself in freedom and respecting individual rights, it's really incredible that this has evolved. And the fact that Pennsylvania played a role in this is something that we cannot be very proud of.
Your question raises an interesting point about the history of solitary confinement. After Michael's point of how it developed in Pennsylvania, it was generally seen as inhumane. Charles Dickens visited it and said this drives people mad. Eventually, by the 1900s, the Supreme Court weighed in and said this seems to be cruel. And solitary confinement was basically done away with in this country at the end of the 19th century. And for about 70, 80 years, we saw only very limited uses of it. Its rise coincided with the rise of mass incarceration in the 1970s and 80s. As prison systems expanded, they became overcrowded, more violent, and the use of solitary increased. That's number one. And number two, as we as a society said, you have to take every minor crime, drug possession, you know, whatever it is, and put people in jail. Once they got to jail, prison officials responded the same way. Every minor violation was met with send the person to solitary. So I think it's a result of an increasing punitive attitude towards all kinds of violations that occurred in the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Chandra Delaney, we're down to just less than 30 seconds, but very quickly, is anything being done in Texas, any kind of reconsideration of how of the use of solitary confinement being discussed among legislators there?
This is actually in Dallas, Pennsylvania. Dallas, Pennsylvania is where the Dallas 6 case took place. But I think what we are doing is trying to come together with coalitions to work with the governor and the DOC to get something changed in the system.
I want to thank you very much for taking part in our conversation, Chandra Delaney. Also with us is Professor Jules Lobel of the University of Pittsburgh, organizing the two-day conference at the University of Pittsburgh that begins tomorrow, looking at alternatives to prolonged isolation during incarceration. Our other guest, Professor Michael Zygmunt of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. Gentlemen and ladies, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Until tomorrow, so long for now.